Amen. Council, before we begin, both sides have been allowed 15 minutes of arguments. Let me check. Is it Mr. Glass? Good morning to you and Mr. Guinan. And Mr. Story. Do any council have any questions before we begin? Before you approach Mr. Glass, Mr. Guinan and Mr. Story, are you going to split the time?
We are.
Very good. And you realize you're responsible for figuring out when 8 minutes have passed.
Yes.
Very good. Any other questions? Mr. Glass, you may approach and you may proceed.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, here requesting that the motion for summary judgment be overruled, overturned, remanded to the district court for trial. The trial court erred in sustaining defense foundation objections to exhibits that the defendants themselves provided in discovery. That's the first issue. Second issue is by determination by the trial court determining whether a factual issue was yet to be decided by prior fact, the word suitable in Nebraska revised statute in 39-1345. And then in my third argument, by ruling that pursuant to Nebraska revised statute 39-1345, that defendant satisfied any duty of care. That obviously is intertwined with the factual issues that need to be determined by prior fact. And then the fourth issue in finding that the defendants met the standard of care as such standard of care is a genuine issue, material fact. And with that, there's also another issue which appellees are arguing as it relates to acquired immunity. And I don't even think that a particular issue is ripe here today. And even if we do decide acquired immunity, I believe, you know, there are procedural issues and you have the statute of limitations and cap on damages and acquired immunity. You can still be sued. State can still be sued if you have acquired immunity. There has to be determination of negligence. So as it relates to and sustaining defendants' foundation objections, I think this court, going into summary judgment after discovery closes, having to have laid foundation for any particular issue or exhibit or that may warrant some defense on a summary judgment would drastically change the practice of law. If I would have to go through extensive discovery and depositions that could take days, if opposing party is supplying me with a particular document and sworn discovery, then I should be given the latitude and on a summary judgment motion, because I'm the opposing party, providing the document received from the moving party. Therefore, I should be given latitude in that I shouldn't have to provide foundation on a summary judgment at the summary judgment stage. That's for trial.
Have we ever said anything like that?
Not to my knowledge.
So you're in essence asking us to say on summary judgment, just because you got something from the other side that they have confessed foundation, relevance, and all the other evidentiary objections. Is that your position?
That's not my position. My position is that foundation could be laid in a simple issue on a contract. Simply, it could be laid at trial. So this isn't something that should be very difficult to lay foundation for. But at the summary judgment stage, if you don't know what issues are going to be before the court on summary judgment, and we have a document that's relevant, that was supplied by opposing party, we're not saying that we're establishing foundation at that particular point in time.
Yeah, aren't you saying you don't have to establish foundation at that point in time?
I don't think you should have to establish foundation for every particular issue or document that could arise in the future. I am. That's correct. And
counsel, isn't foundation even more important on a summary judgment motion where the judge doesn't have the witnesses in front of him or her and has to rely only on the documents? Isn't that why we only have certain sorts of evidence that can be offered and received in support of a summary judgment?
That's correct. And when in discovery, you receive a request for production of documents, a sworn statement saying that the documents provided to you are true and accurate and authentic. And on top of that, receiving those documents through request for production, sworn statement saying this is the true and accurate document, receiving that particular document and then offering that particular document in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, the non-moving party is giving latitude in these particular issues. And I think that's well-known law.
If you had a discovery response that said, here is a true and correct copy of this contract between these parties, couldn't you offer that as the foundation?
And we did. We did. We did specifically offer those requests for production of documents that included OSHA, and the court cut our OSHA legs off. And that's part of the reason why I believe we're here is because OSHA plays a large role in our argument and whether or not we can hold contractors negligent, or the trier of fact would have to hold them negligent. But exactly right. That's exactly what we did. And the district court, I believe, erred in sustaining the foundation objections.
If we were to have evaluated, or if the trial court could evaluate the documents that you seek to have admitted, is this a correct summary? They would have shown that various defendants were bound by OSHA standards, and that your argument would be, is that correct? These OSHA standards would have an impact on whether or not defendants met their standard of care.
That's
where
exactly
you're going?
Right. That's
okay.
Exactly
and
right.
And the OSHA documents to which you, or the OSHA standards to which you refer, what kind of standards were they about? Were they about closed roads, or were they about minimum traffic roads? Were they about flashing lights? What would it have done for your client?
Thank you. And I would also refer to the Bailey case that's been before this court, in that similarly, and that would fall under the Exhibit 103, the particular section of OSHA, the subcontractor will be responsible to find competent person capable of identifying predictable hazards or peculiarly hazardous conditions, such as the crane, 4,500-ton crane that was moved into the westbound lane so that traffic could flow through, according to the supervisor, Mr. Rennie. And further, that case, as it relates to Bailey and it relates to our particular case, we have the same expert. And his expert Stentz, he would come in and say that, and then we get into hard closure and soft closure, but whether or not we know that someone's driving through what's supposed to be a hard closure, and you have a peculiarly hazardous condition, such as the crane, we should have funneling. We should have lights on the crane. If there's fog, it should be a well-lit up object so that we don't put public in danger. And in this particular situation, an officer of the Omaha tribe responding to an emergency. So to answer your question, I believe that OSHA would provide us with those particular factual issues that need to be determined by the trier of fact.
Would the OSHA regulations that you seek to get before the court have said cranes need to be lit in a non-closed road?
Well, even more so, I believe that they would have to have lights on the crane in a road that was what they term the soft closure, whether that particular term is to be decided by a trier of fact is another reason why we're here, along with a litany of other issues as it relates to the soft closure. So I believe that's exactly right, that you would have to take further precaution to protect the public from the hazardous condition.
Wasn't there evidence that the deceased in this case knew about the closure?
That's a great question.
Does that fact come into play here at all?
I believe it does, and I have about 1 minute, and I'm going to answer it succinctly, and that is that this is an interesting issue of this case, is this is a second part of a project. So there was part one of the project wherein the officers had regularly used this Highway 94 to travel to and from Walt Hill to assist in emergencies or otherwise do their duties. Now, my understanding is the crane was removed from part one, and then there was a part two of the project where the crane had to be brought back. So there was a period of time where the crane was not in the road, and these officers and other individuals were passing through. And so when the crane was put back in the production on the Highway 94 project, Officer Carrillo stated in his deposition that he hadn't seen it prior to driving through that particular section of the highway until that evening. And that evening he happened to miss the crane. Officer Blackbird was traveling at a slower speed behind Officer Carrillo and made contact with the crane. So unfortunately,
I beg your pardon. I do have a question. I know you're trying to reserve some time. If this court were to conclude that the appellees carried their various respective burdens, including evidence of the standard of care required of the defendants, and if the burden shifted to you, what is your best evidence that the standard of care by the various defendants was not followed?
Well, that comes down to a factual issue. Those are factual issues that need to be determined before the standard of care is determined. Then you have what are suitable barricades, determining the sufficiency of warning signs, public highway is closed, whether it was closed, whether there was a hard closure, a soft closure, and whether or not 60-611.
And I beg your pardon. I understand those are the factual issues. What witness did you present that would have spoken to those items?
Expert Stentz. So Terry Stentz, University of Nebraska. He was also the expert in the Bailey case that was before this court, and he would testify to those issues as well. If I may have the rest of my time reserved for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Guyon, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Pat Guyon. I represent the subcontractor DP Sawyer, which was the signed subcontractor on this particular project. I and Mr. Story are going to be presenting an argument on behalf of all the defendants because we believe that the issues in this case are resolved for all defendants under the scope of Nebraska Revised Statute 39-1345. So on July 27, 2020, Judge Sampson entered summary judgment on behalf of all defendants because under 39-1345, DP Sawyer, by extension the rest of the defendants, met their duty of installing suitable traffic devices that warned the public that Highway 94 was closed. And also under that same statute, that Officer Blackbird entered the work area at his own peril and was strictly liable for this accident because he did not have the NDOT's permission to enter that closure.
Counsel, your briefing, all the defendants' briefing, talks a lot about the plaintiff being strictly liable. Mm-hmm. And I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around that. Are you importing that term from our strict liability in tort jurisprudence, which applies to manufacturers? Do you mean something different? Do you mean contributory negligent per se?
Well,
what do you mean?
Well,
because plaintiffs aren't strictly liable for anything.
Well, under this statute, whoever enters a closure enters at their own peril. They don't have the deal. So that if they don't have the NTOT's permission. So the question becomes, what does peril mean? Well, peril means it means risk, right? You've accepted the risk of entering into a closure. You've accepted the results of the accident if you enter without the NDOT's permission. Now, whether I know that there was some quibbling below whether or not that was strict liability or was that assumption of risk, it doesn't really matter because under the statute, it says that you shall enter, you shall be responsible at your own peril, or you shall have assumed the risk as a matter of law. When you don't have, when somebody enters a closure and does not have the NDOT permission, they are going to be liable. This statute here is a risk allocation statute.
But it's liable. I mean, you're not suing Mr. Blackburger.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's they assume their risk. They are responsible for their injuries. What this states is what this statute says.
Use the term assumption of risk.
The statute says enters at their own peril. So what this statute is doing is allocating the risk of injury to whoever enters a closure without the NDO's permission. In other words,
I beg your pardon. Let me interrupt right there and take the statute one piece at a time. The statute does, quote, permit some folks to enter, correct?
If they have permission to enter, correct.
Right. And if they do so, they do so at their own peril, correct?
I think it says without the NDOT's permission is when they enter at their own peril.
Well, do some entrants have permission under Chapter 60, emergency vehicles and so forth?
There's no exception under the emergency vehicle statute for entering a road closure.
Are you looking specifically at that kind of geography, a road closure? In other words, you think that the Chapter 60 statute says you can go through red lights, but you can't go in a construction zone. Could an emergency vehicle go if a worker on the site was injured?
I don't know. They're going to respond to that question, that call. But the question becomes, can they sue this? Can somebody who enters that closure sue the state? And by extension, as contractors. And that may be a question that could be asked in that scenario of Jeff Francis and Robert Davis. Does an emergency vehicle responding to an accident in this facility have your permission to respond to it in here? Don't know what the answer is going to be. That's not the scenario that happened. The scenario we had is he was cutting through a road closure. Remember, these closures, the reason they're closed is because these are dangerous areas. Construction sites change daily. There's no way to anticipate what's going to happen. So the legislature made a policy decision saying, hey, look, we know whether for good reasons or bad reasons, somebody's going to disregard our road closure signs and somebody's going to enter into these closures. But what we've decided to do is whether it's a good reason or a bad reason, you're going to be responsible for your own injuries. You can't sue the state, and by extension, you can't sue its contractors. They made that policy choice.
Do we need to
Let me direct your attention to 60-6114, right? That's the one about authorized emergency vehicles.
Correct.
Is your argument therefore consistent with subpart 3 that if you're an emergency vehicle, nevertheless, you're not relieved from the duty to drive with due regard for the safety of all persons, perhaps yourself included?
Well, that's what the court ended up addressing, saying, hey, look, you know, at the end of the day, if we were to accept everything that the plaintiffs are saying, he's still responsible, Blackburn's still responsible for his own actions and driving through. It dovetails with 39-1345. But I guess I would go to Justice Stacey. I don't know that we need to get to this issue. I don't think we need to get to this issue because he did not, under 39-1345, the question becomes, contractors meet their duty to install these road closed barricades and signs that warn the public that the road was closed. Remember, the NDOT decides what are suitable signs. The NDOT tells us what we are supposed to put up there. Our responsibility, our duty under the state specifications is you must follow that plan. You cannot deviate from that plan. So our duty is to install these devices as the NDOT tells us to do. That was the first basis which the judge granted a summary judgment, saying, yeah, you were supposed to put up these signs that the NDOT specified in these traffic control plans or in the traffic control plan, and you met that duty. We didn't have a duty beyond that to determine what devices were suitable, what devices should be placed, or what devices should be added. That was completely the NDOT's discretion.
Beg your pardon. If this court were to conclude that defendant's evidence carried their burden that you met your duty, which duty was to follow the plan, then do you agree the burden would then shift with respect to the standard of care to the plaintiff? And if so, what was their evidence that might have put duty at issue? Maybe that's not a fair question to you. It's the same question I asked opposing counsel.
What I think I understand what you're saying is they had a responsibility to add, to offer evidence at the summary judgment hearing that there was a question of fact whether or not we met our duty. They did not offer any evidence. There was no disputed fact at trial that the barricades that were used to enclose the hard closure were not suitable. They didn't offer any evidence to rebut that evidence. So there wasn't a question of fact. And so the standard on review, obviously, was there a question of fact we met our duty? Not with regard to the hard closure. We met our duty, our responsibility to follow the traffic control plan, and they did not offer any evidence that those traffic control devices, the barricades and signs, were not suitable for that closure. They went and focused in on the crane itself. That was 100 yards away from this hard closure. So the standard is under 391345, and did we meet our standard under that statute? We're hired by the state to do what they tell us to do. And we met our obligations to the state by putting up the signs that they required and asked us to put up. I see my time is done beyond the 8 minutes, and I would like Mr. Story to have an opportunity to speak. So thank you very much.
Mr. Story, good morning to you.
Good morning to the court. As Mr. Gainan said, I too have been designated by all of the appellees to speak on their behalf. I think the key to this case is we can start with 391345, but there is a failure at every level of the elements for the negligence case in here. And we start with the duty and whether or not any of these appellees had a duty to Mr. Blackbird. And if you look at that 1345 and you look at the statute, it's clear in all the evidence in the record that it's the Nebraska Department of Transportation's duty to determine whether or not they're suitable barricades. And so that question falls on the NDOT and does not fall on any of the appellees. In addition, there are four different appellees in this case that have a different contractual relationship with each other. And although they treat us all appellees as a monolith, we have to look at each appellee and their role with this project. So Knife River is the prime contractor. They hired my client, M.E. Collins, to do some repair, and M.E. Collins hired A.M. Corin to bring in the crane. They had nothing to do with the signs and barricades. The only party that had direct duty with the signs and barricades is D.P. Sawyer. So as the court analyzes this case, and even if you find that there was a duty and that there are factual questions as to whether or not there was a breach of the duty, it needs to be done on an individual level. But the problem with the appeal, and I think that we can talk about the statute, which is a unique statute. We did a lot of research looking for similar statutes in states across the country, and the use of at his own peril and the general structure of that statute is unique. But at the end of the day, there is no facts. As the appellant argued in his at the beginning of this oral argument, that there's a lot of factual issues. But none of those factual issues have been identified by the appellants. And that was their burden in response to overwhelming evidence from the appellees that the only party, the only entity that had a duty with regard to the barricades was the Nebraska Department of Transportation. You can look at Mr. Francis's deposition. You can look at Mr. Davis's deposition. And that establishes, for purposes of this hearing, that the duty was on the NDOT and not any of the appellees. There's also questions raised about the crane, but that crane question fundamentally fails because it's in a closed highway. Now, what duty did they have to identify for the crane? And that was the OSHA regulation. But reading the OSHA regulation as kind of interpreted in the Bailey decision, it only applies to cranes next to a highway in use, in normal use. And despite whether or not it's a soft closure or it's a hard closure, there is no dispute that this highway was not in normal use. And we don't even have to, you know, believe the words of Mr. Francis and Mr. Davis. Officer Carrillo admits in his deposition that they knew that the road was closed and not for normal use.
I beg your pardon, if I may interrupt. Is this correct position that I understand your position, please? the OSHA requirement which appellant seeks to get before the court. In other words, the subcontracts required the defendants to adhere to OSHA, and that OSHA standard that the plaintiff would seek to rely on is that if the road is in normal use or partially closed, the crane must be lit. And your answer evidently is, so what? This is a closed road.
This is a closed road. I mean, it's undisputed. The facts are undisputed that the traffic wasn't, that highway was not in use. There is questions raised about whether or not vehicles were going around the barriers, and those factual issues may be in dispute, but what the import of those is, it's irrelevant. The highway was closed by the NDOT. The sign says the highway was closed. The barricades prevented vehicles from crossing into the closed area.
Does the record show whether the barricades completely closed off both lanes?
Yes, I believe there's, first, I think that's in Francis's deposition. He was the project manager for the NDOT. He testifies that before and after the accident, the barriers did so. We also included, and I believe it's in our ME Collins brief, pictures of these barricades. And you can see clearly where the hard closure is. The type 3 barricades block the entire road. And if you read Officer Carrillo's deposition and how they circumvented that, they had to go off the road in order to do that. And this case, and this court has actually kind of addressed that issue before, and that's the Gorgeous case, in which this court held that the purpose of a barricade on a highway is to impede travel and to warn the public, which is consistent with the statute 39-1345, that the road is closed. It does not have to stop, be impenetrable. Right, this is out on the highway. You can see from the pictures that if you wanted to make this impenetrable, you may have had to extend those barricades into the farmers' fields. And so the purpose of the statute, which is consistent with Nebraska common law going back many decades, is that the purpose of the statute of the barricades is to warn and to impede travel. And there's no question here on a factual level. Officer Carrillo, who was a partner of Officer Blackbird, testified that it did impede his travel. He had to drive around it. And there's no question that the road was known to be closed to Mr. Blackbird himself, because in the days prior to the accident, he had warned Ms. Blackbird that the highway had been closed. And so this is an unfortunate circumstance where an officer took a chance. He took a risk by going around barricades, and that risk unfortunately resulted in his death. But the key is that just because an accident occurred, and we instruct juries on this all the time in the state of Nebraska, just because an accident occurred doesn't mean there's negligence. And in this instance, the overwhelming evidence in the case is that the appellees, the 4 contractors, did nothing wrong. They followed Nebraska statute. They followed the directive of the NDOT. And for those reasons, and for the reasons stated in our brief, they did not breach any duty. And to the extent that they breached any duty, there's this unique question on 1345 regarding what does so at his own peril. And I understand that we had trouble trying to figure out that language too, but at the end of the day, the key is that the only person's negligence that caused this accident, unfortunately, is Officer Blackbird's. And as of a matter of law, if you get to proximate cause, the appellees were not the approximate cause of his death. And for all those reasons, we ask you this.
Don't we have a settled proposition of law in Nebraska that the violation of a state statute or an ordinance regarding traffic is evidence of negligence, but is not negligence or contributory negligence per se? We've said that over and over for decades, haven't we?
Yes.
Why would that rule be any different here? Why wouldn't it just be evidence of contributory negligence and not contributory negligence per se?
Well, the reading of the statutes, you'd have to make those statutes read in conjunction. And part of this problem is we don't know what at his own peril means. There is no interpretation of that. But for application in this case, and you may be right, Your Honor, and I trust that you are, but for application in this case, there is no evidence of anyone else's negligence. And so if it's evidence of Mr. Blackbird's negligence, then that's the only evidence of negligence in this case. And therefore, he is, by essentially being an efficient intervening cause, his negligence is the proximate cause of his own death.
If I may, Mr. Chief Justice, may I ask an additional question?
Hey.
In 39-102, there's an indication that the highway chapter should be read consistent with the rules of the road which we understand to include Chapter 60. So in trying to divine at your own peril, would we be informed by Chapter 60, where Chapter 60 permits emergency vehicles to go into, go against certain rules of the road, but with safety in mind? Would we read those together?
Yes, Your Honor. I think you do have to read the statutes together, as you indicated. But if you look at 66114 and 60113, both of those statutes do not allow for this situation. It allows for very specific instances, such as speeding or running a red light. There's no discussion about road closures. And so the exclusion or the non-inclusion of an area where there is, by not including, allowing them to enter a closed road, when you read the statutes together, that would indicate that 39-1345 would control in that situation. And those statutes, and I would also point out in 6114, they both carve out that the person who is violating the rules of the road under these exceptions must do so under greater care. And I think that informs us of the at his own peril. It informs us that once you do that, the driver is now responsible for any accidents or injuries that may occur at that point.
Thank you.
And for all those reasons, we ask that you affirm the grant of summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, for 3 minutes, 1 second.
3 minutes and 11 seconds, Mr. Glass.
A lot of conversation about at your own peril. At your own peril, you know, is it whether or not Officer Blackbird goes into this road closure and smashes into the state sign and he has to pay for it at his own peril? Is it that because there could be a determination of negligence on behalf of the appellees and the contractors that if they don't perform their contracts according to the contracts, then is he at his own peril? Is a question that I've been juggling as well. So if we don't perform our contracts appropriately, according to the Arkansas case that I had cited, that whether or not, you know, that, and this goes back to acquired immunity, but should they summary judgment out if they don't follow their own contracts, or should they be immune because they didn't follow their own contracts and they're negligent? I believe that it is difficult to sit here and attempt to reconcile the Chapter 30 and 60. This is clearly proximate cause is a factual issue, and contributory negligence is certainly part of the argument. I think that if you go back to the Davis and Francis depositions, they state that if the contractors knew individuals were driving through the road closure, as Rennie stated, he moved the crane so people could continue to drive through the road closed. Is it really a hard closure? And if it's not, then contractors need to go back to the DOT and say, hey, we have people driving through here. What do we do? They never did. The contractors never did that. The site supervisor never did that. Do they have a duty to do that? Is it a factual issue of whether or not we have a hard closure or soft closure?
Is there any evidence in the record that the appellees were aware that police or other emergency vehicles were still utilizing the road prior to the day of the accident?
I think the term used was heavy traffic. They had heavy traffic going through this part one of the project, which was a soft closure, and then it had become what the DOT said was a hard closure, but for Rennie moving the crane because of all of these cars still passing through. I asked that question in the deposition of Mr. Rennie, whether or not he saw law enforcement officers driving through there. And I believe he said he had not. Whether or not that was truthful, I don't know, because in Carrillo's deposition, he had said that we use that Highway 94 because it's the quickest route in emergencies to get from point A to point B, and we see these contractors regularly. So I believe that this court should remand back to the district court. Thank you. Without any other questions, may I be excused?
You may.
And so you may be excused. That concludes arguments on Blackbird versus Knife River Inc. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Kauk versus Kauk.